Some of you may be old enough to remember back to 1976. So instead of embarrassing people who can remember that, let's just go ahead and have everyone raise your hand. If you were not around in 1976, just raise your hand loud and proud. There's a lot of hands up. So let's open the history books and let's talk about 1976. On June 27th, 1976, armed operatives for the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, also known as the PFLP, surprised a crew of 12 on Air France jetliner. They took 91 passengers hostage. Does anyone remember this? 91 passengers, Air France jet, taken hostage. They took this plane and they took off and they were going to fly to an unknown, undesignated location. Well, it had all been planned. They ended up being tracked to the middle of Africa. They landed in Uganda. They stayed there at the airport for 7 days. These hijackers had control, these 91 passengers and 12 crew members, and they were setting up their next move. Well, more than 2,500 miles away in the Tel Aviv area, three Israeli C-130 Hercules were being secretly loaded with Israeli commandos. It only took them a few hours by night. They attacked this airport, and within 60 minutes, the commandos had gained control of the airport. They had rushed the terminal. They had gunned down the hijackers and were able to rescue 110 of the 113 hostages. It was an amazing military rescue. The next day, it was July 4th, and the Israeli premier, Yitzhak Rabin, got on the national television, and he declared triumphantly that the mission would become a legend. And it has. I mean, it was an amazing feat. These Israeli commandos had deep resolve to rescue their people. They went under the stealth of night, and they recovered these captives. Now, it was an amazing feat, and it has become legendary, but I want to suggest to you that it's not a new feat. There was a prior legend. There was one about an Israeli. He wasn't really a commando, but he did go under the stealth of night to recover hostages of his own people. His name was Abram. Did you know that? I think it's funny. Some people don't think the Bible is interesting. They've never read it. I mean, we have hostage rescues. I mean, we have night attacks. It's incredible. Here in our text this morning in Genesis chapter 14, we're going to encounter Abram. He's going to gather a group together of soldiers. By night, they're going to attack these people who have taken his family hostage, and they're going to recover them. It's a rather interesting story in Genesis chapter 14. Now, the way I'm going to go through this, I'm going to summarize verses 1 through 12. And if you just take a moment to look at verses 1 through 12, you'll know why. Go ahead, look. But I'm going to leave all those names to you this afternoon, okay? You just sit around the lunch table and you guys try to pronounce all those. But I'm going to summarize them, okay? I'm going to summarize these first 12 verses and kind of set the stage for what's going to happen in this passage. In the land of Canaan, near where Abram was staying, there was a ruler named Chedorlaomer. Now, take a look at it in verse number 1. Do you see that? It kind of looks like Chedorlaomer. Kind of like cheddar cheese. So we're going to call him King Cheddar because he was, in fact, the big cheese in this region. Now, I say that because there were at least 8 other vassal kings that paid tribute to King Cheddar. Okay, so that's what we're going to call him. The rest is, I'm not going to try to say Chedorlaomer every single time. We're just calling him King Cheddar. Well, here in this region near where Abram lived, Cheddar had these vassal kings that paid tribute to him yearly. And the arrangement worked for about 12 years. For about 12 years, he was able to extract tribute and goods and money and enrich himself at the expense of these other people. Well, that is until, in this passage, five of the kings decide, we're tired of this. We're sick of taxation without representation. And so they take a bunch of cheese and throw it in the Boston Harbor. Starts this big thing called the Revolutionary War. Now, I'm mixing up a little bit of history. That's not what they do. They just decide, no, we're not going to do this. We're going to rebel against this taxation by this king. We're not going to pay him anymore. And so these five kings decide they're not going to go along with it, and they rebel. That's in verse number 4. So if you look there, 12 years they had served King Cheddar. In the 13th year, they rebelled. Okay, well, this overlord can't have that. I mean, think about the mob. Think about the mafia. You can't have people who refuse to pay. It doesn't work. So here, this overlord, he's going to have his income strategy ruined, and he's not going to stand for it. And so he gathers the remaining loyal vassal kings, gathers them together. So now it's King Cheddar and three others who are still loyal to him. So a party of 4, and they're going to go against 5. And that's what you see in verse number 9. The last part of the verse, of verse number 9, says 4 kings against 5. That's King Cheddar, his 3 allies, against the 5 kings who rebelled. Now, as we look at this passage, we're going to find that they go to war, and the 5 rebellious kings are quickly subdued. Quickly subdued. Look at verse number 10. Now, in the valley of Siddim was full of bitumen pits, like tar pits. The kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled. Some fell into them. The rest fled to the hill country. So the enemy, this is King Cheddar and his alliance, the enemy took all the possessions of Sodom and Gomorrah and all the provisions and went their way. They quickly put an end to the rebellion. Now at this point, some of you may be wondering, what's the big idea of this whole war with all these names and these different kings and people getting defeated? Why does this really matter? Is it important because it's the first war recorded in Scripture? Well, it is the first war recorded in Scripture, but I don't think that's why it's important. Is it important because we really need to know a key figure named Chedorlaomer? No, that's really not why either. The reason that we're told all of these verses up through verse number 12 is because it sets the stage for how life is going to intersect with Abram. Remember, God has called Abram. He's made particular promises to him. And now this war is going to intersect with Abram's life. More to the point, it's going to intersect with his nephew's life. Now, why is that? How does his nephew get involved in this war? Well, you'll notice with me in verse number 12, it says, they also took Lot, the son of Abram's brother, who was dwelling, where was he living? He was dwelling in Sodom and his possessions and went their way. It's a very interesting contrast between chapter 14, verse 12, and chapter 13, verse 12. Take a look at chapter 13, verse 12. Abram settled in the land of Canaan, while Lot settled among the cities of the valley and moved his tent as far as Sodom. So here in chapter 13, verse 12, we find he's getting close to Sodom. He's not in Sodom. He's kind of living in that valley near Sodom. But by the time we get to chapter 14, verse 12, it says he is not living near Sodom. He's living in Sodom. And so what has happened is Lot has taken up residence in this sinful, wicked city, and now they went to war, and so he becomes one of the refugees who are captured as spoils of war, and all of his possessions are gone. Now, this is why we're told this whole setting, because now Abram has a choice to make. Now, what would you do? I've come up with a new name for Lot. We're not told what his last name is, but I've come up with a new name. I've come up with a middle and a last name for Lot. We're going to call him Lot of Trouble. Lot of Trouble. Because that's all he is, the entire story. He is a lot of trouble to Abram and anyone else he's with. Because he really doesn't live a righteous life. I mean, he lets his righteous soul be vexed over and over and over again and causes a lot of trouble. Now, what would you do if you were Abram? You've got this stupid nephew who's made some really poor and sinful choices. I mean, contrary to your own moves and contrary to your own example, he decides he wants the Jordan Valley. He decides he wants to move near the city of wickedness. He decides he wants to take up residency there. Well, listen, he made his bed. Now he can sleep in it. How do you respond to people in your life who constantly make poor and sinful choices? Do you ever feel like washing your hands of those people? You're like, listen, I've spent enough time and enough energy trying to get this person to make the right choices, and they've decided they're not going to do it, so let them go. I've felt that way. I have an extended family member. I remember the drama growing up, just hearing about this family member. She first married a guy who believed that Old Faithful was turned on and off by pipes. He wasn't the sharpest tack in the box, you know. I still remember this Christmas. He's trying to convince me. And I'm probably like 11, and I'm like, no. Something's wrong up there. She married that guy first. He ended up, actually, he was a violent man, and they ended up divorcing. Well, she makes this smart move to marry his brother. It goes from bad to worse. You know, contrary to everybody's counsel and opinion, she decides to marry his brother. Well, he's of the same character, a violent man. He ends up going to jail. She divorces him. You'd think that would be enough. So while visiting him in jail, she meets another inmate and begins to write this inmate and ends up marrying him when he gets out of jail. I mean, it's just like one after another. I'm pretty sure you're just like, listen, you are a series of bad choices, and I wash my hands of you, right? I wonder if that's how Abram felt about Lot. Like, listen, you just won't get it straight. You just won't listen. You're bent on doing what's wrong, so let him go. Maybe that's how I would have been, but that's not how Abram was. And actually, I don't think that's the way we're supposed to be. I don't think we're really permitted to leave a fallen brother behind. And so Abram doesn't. He's actually going to go and chase after Lot. You're going to find in verse number 13, when one who had escaped came and told Abram, the Hebrew, who was living by the oaks of Mamre, the Amorite, brother of Eshcol and Aner, says these were the allies of Abram. When Abram heard that his kinsmen had been taken captive, he led forth his trained men born in his house. So he decides he's going to go after him. I think sometimes maybe we get tempted to leave a fallen, sinful brother behind because we're just tired of their mistakes and poor choices. I don't know about you, but as I study this, I was reminded of Galatians chapter 6, verse 1. Says there, brothers, if anyone is caught in a transgression, if there's someone in your life who's made the poor choices of going towards Sodom, who's tripped up in their sinful decisions, if there's someone who's caught in any transgression, you who are spiritual should restore him in a spirit of gentleness. Go to him. Restore him. We're not free to wash our hands of people who make poor and sinful choices. We have to seek after them. I think it's interesting, isn't that what Christ has done for each of us? Imagine if God washed his hands of us. Oh, there Lucas goes again. Dumb choice. I'm sick of him. I'm done with him. No, you know, each one of us are like that one sheep who left the 99 and wants to go his own way, but God in his grace didn't crumple us up and throw us away. Instead, he went out by night and found us in our own mess, puts us over his shoulders, and carries us back. And so we're supposed to do to our brethren who've kind of gone off of the path. Well, for some of us, what that means is we have to have a hard conversation. We have to go find someone. We have to make a phone call or send a text to someone who's straying from the Lord. But for Abram, it meant a whole lot more than a phone call or a text. If Abram was going to go after Lot, it meant war. He was going to have to go to war. And that's exactly what happens here. Abram does, in fact, go to battle, and it's a result of his active faith in God. Now, I want to differentiate a few things that we've seen already and we're yet to see in the book of Genesis with Abram. I say active faith because active faith is the sort of trust and dependence in God that causes you to do something. Like, you trust in God's protection. You trust that God can give you the victory, so you go and you do something. You trust that God can work in the situation, and so you decide you're going to say something. So active faith is the faith or the trust in God that pushes you to do something. It's different from passive faith. Passive faith is the sort of faith that rests in God. You rest in God's providence. You believe that he's going to work things out for good. We saw that with Abram already, right? In the last chapter, we see him standing with Lot, and he says to Lot, "Lot, you choose where you want to go. If you go to the right hand, I'll go to the left. If you go to the left, I'll go to the right. You choose." Why was he able to do that? Because he had passive faith. He had a rest in God, that God was going to providentially work it out for his glory and his good. And so he could passively place his faith in God. So active faith, passive faith. I think there's probably one more we're going to see in the next chapter. Prayerful faith. What we're going to find in the next chapter, chapter 15, Abram's going to talk to God. He's going to say, "Oh Lord God, what will you give me? I continue childless. The heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus. Behold, you've given me no offspring, and the member of my house will be my heir." He's just praying, trusting God. He's not wavering in unbelief here. In faith, he's praying to God. At the end of that passage where God interacts with Abram, we'll see this next week, it says he believed the Lord. He had faith in the Lord, and it was counted to him as righteousness. And so in Abram's life, we're going to see active faith, passive faith, prayerful faith. But here in our text this morning, we see him doing something. His trust in God moves him to do something. I want to suggest to you that if you've gone through your whole life, you say, "Well, I'm really just a proponent of passive faith. I'm kind of a proponent of that. I just kind of sit back and let God work," you know. Well, in some instances, that's good. But you could be actually a disobedient Christian, because you're not just supposed to have passive faith. You're also supposed to have active faith. Let me flip the coin. If you're always rushing in, "I'm just going to do it. I'm going to go for it. I know I've got to do something." If you're always doing that, and you can't stop and rest in God, if you're always pursuing active faith, but you have no passive faith, then you're probably not resting in his sovereignty. Let me just say this. If you have no time for prayer, if you don't entrust to God the things of your life, then you're missing an important component of the walk of a believer, and that is prayerful faith. So all of these are very, very significant, but in this one, we find active faith. It's the sort of active faith that drives him courageously into battle against these four kings. And I think it's because Abram trusts that God alone can provide victory and that God alone pours out blessings. I think that's the first lesson that maybe this morning we should come to understand. And that is that God alone gives victory and God alone gives blessings. It's God alone. We don't have to seek those in other sources. We don't have to try to cultivate them ourselves. It's God who gives victory and blessings. So Abram goes to war to rescue his nephew. He's willing to face the opposition of his world around him. He's willing to risk his life because he believed these two things about God. Victory and blessing come from God alone. He believed those two things, and it caused him, by faith, to go to battle. I'd like to look at each one in turn. So, number one, victory over the world comes from God alone. Victory over the world comes from God alone. Verse number 13. "One who had escaped came and told Abram the Hebrew who was living by the oaks of Mamre." You keep reading, basically, Lot's been taken captive. Verse 14. "Abram heard that his kinsmen had been taken captive, and he led forth his trained men born in his house." How many of them? 318 of them. "And he went in pursuit as far as Dan." Now, some of you might be thinking, "Man, that's a huge army, 318. Really? No, 318 really isn't a huge army. We're talking about four kings. One of them is the big dog, the big cheese, King Cheddar and his cohorts. And they've got their armies, and they're very, very powerful. And what we find here is that Abram has 318. You say, yeah. But didn't you catch that, Lucas? They're trained men. Some of you might be thinking they're commandos, but that's probably not true. These were Bedouins. We're talking a bunch of farmers and herdsmen. Now, maybe they knew how to use a staff. Maybe they had some sickles and slings, a couple swords here and there, and perhaps a spear. But we're not talking about commandos here. They had no martial arts training. You're not going to see any Chuck Norris moves from these 318 guys. They didn't have sniper rifles. They didn't have any of these RPGs. They can blow up people from a distance. They didn't have luchador eagle powers. They didn't have anything like this. All they had were 318 guys, some staffs, some sticks, some swords, some spears, and a few slings. And these guys are going to go to battle against four kings and their forces. So I'm just telling you, as we set the stage here, Abram's opposition was a formidable challenge. It was not like, oh yeah, this is in the bag. We've got it. 318 of us, we've got it. No, this was going to be terrifying. They were outnumbered. It was going to be scary. But by faith, he was willing to go to war because he believed. Remember I said there's two things to believe about God. He believed that victory was from God. Victory's not from your numbers. Victory's not from your might. Victory's not from your strategy. Victory's not from your wisdom. Victory comes from God. And so he was willing to do something very hard. He was willing to go against this opposing force, this formidable challenge. Now, the reason I'm suggesting that these kings and their forces were very strong are because of a few verses that I did not read. They're in that section. Remember, I said I was going to summarize. They're in verses 5 through 7. Now, as I was reading this text, I came across verses 5 through 7 and wondered, why in the world are those verses there? They don't even include the set of five kings that go to war with the four kings. These are just some other people. Why did they include that? It seems like you could skip from verse 4 to 8, leave out 5 through 7, and you'd be just fine with the story. Why did he put these people in there? In that section of verses 5 through 7, it says that this group of kings, King Chedor and his cohorts, they defeat the Rephaim, the Zuzim, the Emim, the Horites, Amalekites, and Amorites. Says they defeated all these people groups on their way down to fight against Sodom, Gomorrah, and these other kings that had rebelled. Why does it include those defeats? I think it does that just to show us that this was a strong military force. They were already able to wipe out all of these other peoples. And listen, they could wipe out 318 men, at least humanly speaking. So I think what we have here is really the expression of a formidable challenge, of opposition that was great. When you think of King Chedor, you're not going to get these fat IRS guys with their suspenders and their pocket protectors and they're pushing up their nose saying, you need to pay your taxes. That's not what you get. You get this king with his soldiers and they're going to come and raid your city and destroy it and take all of your stuff. That's what they do. They took these five kings, they wiped them all out, and they took all their stuff and their people, and they took them away captive. Abram decides with his 318 men, he's going to go up to battle against them. Abram courageously faces the opposition of the world around him because he had faith that victory comes from God. Now, I want to suggest that in our own life, we have opposition from the world around us. I mean, think for a moment about what it means to live by faith, and then think for a moment of the people who oppose that in your life. And I wonder if you are willing to live faithfully and courageously in the face of opposition because you believe that victory comes from the Lord. Are you willing to face the opposition of the unsaved family members that pressure you? Are you willing to face the opposition of worldly co-workers that have it out for you? Are you willing to face the opposition of neighbors or supposed friends who want nothing to do with God? Are you willing to face the opposition of the world around you because you have faith that victory comes from the Lord? You don't have to live in this city very long to start encountering opposition. It was this last summer. We've really had some struggles with one of our neighbors. It started with grass and dirt clods being thrown over the fence at a worker that we hired to replace tile. So we hired this guy to come in because our bathroom shower was leaking. He had to come in and replace the tile. He's cutting tile out there. Next thing you know, there's these clods of dirt and mud being chucked over the fence at this guy. It didn't start out well. I mean, this is in our first month of moving in. Keep it down. You're too loud. Turn that saw off. I mean, It's the middle of the day. He's doing construction work on the house. He's cutting some tile. You know, it was just at odds. It went on. I mean, our kids in our own lawn. They can't sing a song, can't talk, can't have fun like kids have fun. I mean, at one point, they're picking beans in the back in our own garden, and they're talking, and they're getting chided by the neighbor. Be quiet. My kid's sleeping. Be quiet. And it's like it was on edge. Just opposition, opposition. Well, it culminates in backyard Bible club. The kids' singing was just too loud in our front lawn. And what rolls up? A police car. Yeah, they called the cops because the kids were singing too loud in the front. Yeah. I'm just going to tell you, you're going to try to live by faith. You're going to face opposition. Now, maybe no one's going to call the police on you, all right? But I'm going to tell you something. If you live by faith, you're going to have to be courageous and face the opposition of the world around you. Trusting, resting in the fact that victory comes from the Lord. Now, for Abram, he had faith in God that God could give him the victory. Now, some of you may be looking at this and say, I'm not sure where the expression of faith is. It seems like maybe this is just a macho thing. You're going to take my nephew, I'm going to take my 318, and I'm going to whoop you up. We're going to open a can of whoop up. And is that what's going on with Abram? I'm going to tell you that's not what's going on. He actually has some faith in God. You say, where's the faith? You have to skip down to verse number 22. Skip down there. In verse number 22, we're going to find a flashback. Abram's going to tell us about something that happened in the past. Okay, before he ever went out to war, he says this. And notice it's past tense. I have lifted my hand to the Lord, God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth. What is that saying? Well, here's what's happening. Before he got all these 318 men and they start heading off to a 120-mile chase, if you read the text, they had to go 120 miles. Before he starts out on that, you see some of those 318, they're strapping up their sandals. You see some of these guys getting on their camels, and they're going to, Aner and Eshcol, they're getting on their camels, and they're going to take off. And other guys are strapping up their sandals, and some of them are sharpening their sickles, and they're all getting ready. And then we pan across, and we see Abram. And what's he doing? He's down on his knees, and his hands are raised up. And he says, El Elyon, Yahweh, God Most High, I make a vow to you. It says, I lift my hands to you. It was a symbol of making a vow. He says, I make a vow to you that I will not keep any of the spoils of the victory when you give it to me. Did you catch the when? When you give it to me, I'm not going to keep any of the spoils. That's what it says. You read verse 22 and verse 23. He had already, by faith, in front of all of these people, got down, lifted his hands to the Lord, and said, God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, Yahweh, when you give me the victory, I'm not going to keep any of those spoils because I want you to receive all of the glory. I don't want to be enriched by them. And then he gets off and goes to war. Now, I don't know about you, but some of you have trouble even praying at your work lunch table. Or being in school and saying one mention of God. Or going to work and let anybody know you're a Christian. But here's Abram, 318. These other guys, these from Mamre, Aner, and Eshcol, and all these guys are standing around. And he just gets down on his knees and raises his hands up to God. He says, you are the God Most High. And I make a vow to you that when you give me the victory, you see that faith? When you give me the victory, I'm not going to keep any of the spoils. So by faith, Abram trusted God that he would give him the victory. They get on their camels, their mules, their horses, their feet, whatever it is. We're not sure how they got there, but they go 120 miles. I don't know about you, but a 120-mile journey is a long way, even if you have a camel. And I'm not sure that all 318 of them had camels. There's probably some footmen. I had a buddy of mine. He just turned 30. He's a friend from work. Just turned 30 this last weekend. And he wanted to prove that he had not gone over the hill. 30, that's, whew, you're getting old then. 30, wow. So he was like, no, I'm not old anymore. I can still do the things of my youth. And so he decided he was going to go run 100 miles. Oh, yeah, 100 miles. Some of you know him, Joshua Bryant. He ran with us on Ragnar. He decides he's just going to go out and run 100 miles. Well, he finished. He's okay, hands down. He's good to go for another year. Took him 35 hours and 11 minutes to run 100 miles. I don't know about you, but I don't want to ring in my birthday with a 100-mile run. But he did. 35 hours and 11 minutes of running. Now, this wasn't 100 miles. This was 120. So at that pace, I guess he'd be at about 42 hours and 12 minutes. So here's Abram. Lot's already been gone. They took off, take all these spoils to the north, and Abram says, and remember how old Abram is? Anybody remember? We're talking 75 to 80. He hops on his camel and says, come on, let's go 120 miles. He rides this with these 318 guys. We're talking like 30, 40 hours of riding. And they get there, and you'd imagine that they'd want to take a break. Like, wow, I've got blisters and I'm saddle sore, you know? You can hardly walk. You're like a cowboy, you know? He's like, come here, you guys, I'm going to fight you. But he can hardly walk. That's not what happens. I mean, the Lord just strengthens Abram. I mean, this is an incredible passage if you just catch the details of it. The Lord strengthens him. They go 120 miles. They arrive there at night. It says in verse number 15, so he divides his force against them by night, he and his servants, and defeated them and pursued them to Hobah, north of Damascus, and then pursues them a lot further till finally they're all scattered and there's nothing left. And it says, and he brought back all the possessions and brought back his kinsman Lot with his possessions and the women and the people. I want to just say a few things here as side notes. There are some people who go through life and they don't believe in plans or strategies. They're like, well, bless God, I just trust him. Just they go into marriage and they say, well, we're just going to trust God. They go into business. They don't have a business plan or a business strategy. They just open a business. Well, I'm just going to trust God. They're going to raise kids, but they don't think about how they're supposed to do it. They just say, well, we're just going to trust God. But I'm just going to stop before I say it. That sounds very spiritual, but actually it's very stupid. Because although you're supposed to trust God, God also wants you to plan. The two are not in conflict. You plan and you say, Lord willing, if God wills, if this is his desire, and then you let it go. Abram didn't just go blaze into these five or four kings and their troops. He made a strategy. He planned, we're going to split the people up. We're going to go at night. We're going to have this counterattack. And at the end of the day, it was all from God and not from him. So he didn't trust in his strategy, but he made a strategy. There's a simple verse that people who don't believe in this should read. It's Proverbs 21:31. It says, the horse is prepared for the day of battle, but victory is of the Lord. So it doesn't just say, so go unarmed, don't prep your horse, and just head on out. It says, no, the horse is prepared for the day of battle, and ultimately victory is of the Lord. Well, here's Abram. He makes a strategy, he makes a plan, and victory comes from the Lord. I love how in the New Testament, God's people are called victorious ones. Do you know you're called that in the New Testament? The phrase is overcomers. We're called victorious ones. We're overcomers by God. Like Abram, when we live by faith, God gives victory to his people. I love this passage in 1 John 5, verse 4. It says, everyone who has been born of God overcomes the world. And this is the victory that overcomes the world, even our faith. People who live by faith are given the victory by God. Abram came to understand that victory comes from the Lord. Beyond that, he understood that blessings come from the Lord alone. So victory comes from God alone. Blessings come from God alone. Abram came to embrace that truth. Notice in verse number 17 through 20, we're introduced to a couple of kings. The first king rides up. He is the king of Sodom. So notice verse 17. After his, Abram's return from the defeat of Chedorlaomer and the kings who were with him, the king of Sodom went out to meet him at the Valley of Sheva, or the Valley of Kings. So here he is, he's coming down this valley, out comes riding the king of Sodom, coming out to meet him. But before he can get a word in edgewise, another king enters the scene. Again, this text is very, very interesting because you feel like you could almost skip from verse 17 all the way down to 21. So the king of Sodom comes out to meet him, then skip down to verse 21. The king of Sodom says to Abram, do you see that? It's almost like it picks up. But the author inserts this section. God wants us to see this insert here. And it's significant. But because before the king of Sodom can even get a word out, another king arrives and begins to talk with Abram. So notice verse 18. Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was the priest of God Most High. And he blessed him and said, "Blessed be Abram by God Most High," or El Elyon, "possessor of heaven and earth. And blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand." Abram is going to come to this conclusion that blessing comes from God alone. At first glance in this text, you'd think that Abram earned his blessed status. Abram went to war. Abram defeated the enemy. Abram was courageous. Abram earned all the spoils of war. It kind of looks like that at first glance. But as we keep reading, we encounter this man named Melchizedek who reminds Abram, no, these things didn't come from your hand. They came from the gracious hand of God. Do you see that there? Blessed be God Most High, verse 20, who has delivered your enemies into your hand. So who gave these enemies into Abram's hand? It was God. Who's the possessor of heaven and earth? It's God. And so Melchizedek enters this scene to remind Abram that blessings come from God alone. Do you remember what God had told Abram early on in Genesis chapter 12? In Genesis 12, God had already told Abram, "I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great. I will bless those who bless you, and those who dishonor you I will curse." Well, the king of Chedorlaomer and all of his cohorts were cursed. And who did that? God. Abram was blessed. And who did that? God. And so we're reminded here in this section with King Melchizedek that it is God who alone blesses our lives. I think it's important for us to be reminded of that because sometimes we slip into this delusion. That is, well, hey, if I work 90 hours, then I can bring blessing to my life. Well, hey, if I cultivate all these sales, then I can bring blessing to my family. Hey, if I have the best business savvy, then, hey, if I am a workaholic, hey, if I fix the politics and master the good old boy system, hey, if I can wrangle for rank and muscle my way towards promotion, if I can do all this self-effort, then I can bring blessing to my life. No, my friends, blessing comes from God alone. And that's what Abram was learning here. Remember Psalm 127. It says, "Unless the Lord builds the house, they labor in vain who build it. Unless the Lord watches over the city, the watchman stays awake in vain. It is vain for you to rise up early and go to bed late, eating the bread of anxious toil, without trusting the blessings of God." The blessings of our life come from God, all of them. That's what Melchizedek was reminding Abram. There is one possessor of heaven and earth. There is one God Most High. He is the one who has given your enemies into your hand. He is the one who has given true blessings to your life. My friends, let us not forget what James says in James chapter 1. He says, "Do not be deceived, my beloved brother." Literally, don't be deceived into thinking you can work blessings up in your own life. Don't be deceived into thinking if you put a little more into the mixture, if you add a few more ingredients of self-effort and self-work, then you can produce blessings. Don't be deceived, my beloved brothers, because every good gift and every perfect gift is from above and comes down from the Father of lights, with whom is no variation or shadow to change. At first glance, it looks as though Abram has earned his blessings and fought for his achievement. But in the text, with the introduction of Melchizedek, Abram is reminded and encouraged that the blessings of his life come from God alone. Melchizedek. We could do a whole sermon, and I might just break up the flow and just do a biblical theology of Melchizedek. Because as I studied this week, it's incredible. This guy, Melchizedek, is mentioned in three places. Do you know where they are? Here's one, Genesis 14. Melchizedek arises again in Psalm 110. And then finally in Hebrews, specifically in Hebrews chapter 7. Melchizedek is an interesting man. He's a king priest, and that wasn't normal. Actually, under the Levitical system, you couldn't be a king and a priest. Remember, Saul tried that. He tried to have this overlap where he's going to do offerings. As a result of that, he lost the kingdom. Uzziah tried to mix the two, king, priest. He thought he'd come into the temple and bring some incense. He's struck with leprosy. You don't have king priests under the Mosaic system. But remember, this is prior to Moses. Abram was 500 years prior to Moses. It was prior to the setup of the priestly system. There was no Aaronic priesthood, Aaron and his sons. That hadn't been set up. That'd be another 500 years. Where in the world does this guy who's a priest king, his name Melchizedek, Malek meaning king, and Zedek meaning righteousness, he's the king of righteousness. Where does this king of righteousness come from? He rules over Salem. Does that sound like Shalom or Salam, both which mean peace? The king of righteousness who rules over peace comes out and meets Abram. And they decide they're going to commune over a little meal. Anybody catch what they ate and drank? A little bread and wine. I mean, this is, we're gonna have to do a whole message on this and exegete Psalm 110 and Hebrews 7 and bind it together with this, because this man is an incredible figure that leads us to Jesus. Now, I just want to say this. We don't have time to unpack Melchizedek this morning, but when you see Melchizedek, you should think towards Jesus. When you see Melchizedek, you should think towards Jesus. Melchizedek comes out and reminds and encourages Abram that blessings come from God. Melchizedek says, God Most High is the possessor of heaven and earth. Listen, if you have everything, then you're the only one who can give anything. If you have everything, you're the only one who can give anything. He's reminding Abram, anything good that you have comes from God. I think it's also interesting, Abram encounters a fellow believer here out of nowhere. Like, I don't know about you, but I read Genesis, I'm in Abram, I think, man, he's the only dude who believes in God. I mean, the whole world is turned aside. They're all a bunch of moon worshipers. They're building ziggurats all over the place. Crazy people. They have no knowledge of God anymore. No, out of nowhere comes this guy, Melchizedek, who worships the true and living God. I don't know about you. Have you ever felt really alone in your Christian walk? Maybe you're the only Christian you know in your workplace. Maybe you're the only Christian you know in your college or school. You feel really alone. Maybe you've got ES. It's a syndrome. It's called Elijah syndrome. I alone and left. I am the only one who hasn't bowed my knee to Baal. Everyone else has forsaken you. God says, no, there's 7,000 others. You're not alone. I love this. Here's Abram. He's not alone. In rides Melchizedek, priest of the true and living God. He releases Abram from any symptoms of ES and causes him to celebrate and respond appropriately. Abram then celebrates the victory. How does he celebrate it? He communes with bread and wine. Now, there are a lot of speculations about this, but I just want to suggest this. It is anachronistic to say that Abram and Melchizedek were having communion. They weren't having communion. I know that for a fact. Why? Well, because the Passover doesn't happen for another 500 years. And Jesus doesn't institute Eucharist for another 2,000 years. So you can't say, like, read backwards and say, see, look, they're having communion. No. They were communing with bread and wine, but they weren't having communion. They were celebrating the great work and the gracious blessings of God. So I wanted to tell you this. So they weren't having communion, but we do. And when we do, when we sup around the bread and the wine, we are celebrating the good work and the gracious blessings of God. So here's Abram, and he's doing the appropriate thing and celebrating the goodness of God and the graciousness of God. And when we celebrate communion, when we break bread and drink the wine, we are celebrating God's great work and his gracious blessing. How? Because we're celebrating the work of Jesus. Remember, when you see Melchizedek, think Jesus. We celebrate the work of Christ. The greatest gift, the most gracious expression of love this world has ever known was in Jesus. And we celebrate that through the bread and the wine when we commune together. Well, Abram celebrates and responds. How does Abram respond? I want you to look at the end of verse number 20. And Abram gave, anybody look there? Look at verse 20. He gave a tenth of everything to Melchizedek. Now some of you think, oh, he's going to launch out on a giving sermon. No, I'm not going to launch out on a giving sermon. I do know that some people, they'll build a whole sermon right on that little phrase right there. I just want to suggest this. Here's Abram, and he gives a tithe, a tenth of what he has to this priest of the Most High God, to the Lord. Gives a tenth. You say, well, that's what they're supposed to do, those Old Testament people. They're under the law, give a tenth. It's mandated. Friends, remember, the law hasn't been given. When Abram lived, there was no Mosaic law. Moses comes 500 years later. This is before the law. Before the law, Abram gives 10% of everything to the Lord. I think sometimes people struggle giving to God because they think they've earned their own wealth. They think they've worked their own possessions into their pockets. Some of us think that we own 100% of what we have, and we're going to be generous and give to God 10% of what we have. And doesn't that make us generous people? And look how generous I am. I give a tenth of all that I possess to God. Now, I want to change your thinking. God possesses 100% of what you have. Not you. You don't possess 100% of what you have. God possesses 100% of what you have, and he lets you keep 90. Now, who's gracious then? God is gracious then. You see, sometimes we have it all backwards. We want to make ourselves feel good about giving, when in reality, God is the gracious giver. He gave Abram 90%, 10% he withheld. What is it that you have that you did not receive? Paul writes, if you then received it, why do you boast as if you did not receive it? We are all recipients. When it comes to the law and the placement of the tithe in the law, what we find here in Genesis 14 is that Abram exemplified tithing. The law, which comes 500 years later, will mandate tithing. And then some of you are saying, but we're not under the law, we're under grace. Some people will use that phrase to excuse themselves from giving to God. And what I'd suggest then is you have no idea what grace is. If you think grace excuses you from giving, you really don't understand grace. See, what happens is you have Abram, he exemplifies the tithe. You have the law, it mandates the tithe. But then when you get to the New Testament era, it actually elevates it. You say, more? Do you remember who Jesus commended? There's this widow. She goes to the little offering box at the temple. She drops in two mites, and Jesus says, she has given more than all because she gave everything she had. Do you remember how Paul commends the Macedonians? He said, out of their great poverty, they gave, not just of their money, but of themselves. Do you remember what Paul says? I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, everything to God. Grace doesn't push us to withhold. Grace pushes us to be great givers. 2 Corinthians 8:9, for you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sake he became poor, so that you by his poverty might become rich. Let's follow his example of grace. Well, here's Abram. He learns that victory and blessings come from God. Well, I feel like we're at a juncture where we probably better stop. You say, but you only gave one of the two movements. You only taught us the two things he learned, and you haven't taught us the two things that we need to respond to. Well, I think what we'll do is we'll save that for our next time together. Because if I launch into this next movement, we're going to miss lunch. And not only are we going to miss lunch, we're going to miss everything that follows. And that special dip that you made for this evening, it's all going to be bad. It's going to be bad. What I'd like to do is I'd like to conclude by really coming to grips with what God is teaching us about himself. Okay, so let's just come to grips with this. Number one, God is teaching us that victory comes from him. So you are going to face opposition in this world if you choose to live by faith. You face opposition. But God wants you to have courage and to express faith, trusting that he gives the victory. And second, he wants you to know this, that he is the giver of blessings. You don't work them up. You don't barter with God. You don't earn them or merit them. He gives them. He is the possessor of heaven and earth. He is the God Most High, and he graciously gives blessings to his people. And so I hope this morning that as you leave here, you will reflect upon those two things, that you will go out understanding that victory comes from God and that blessings come from his hand.